And welcome along to this week's RTE Rugby Podcast. A Tuesday pod this week. Ireland against Wales is a Friday night this week. So we said we'd give you a podcast a little bit earlier than usual. A full couch with us as well on this Tuesday. Bernard Jackman is here as usual. And we're also joined by Brett Igoe. Good to have you back in, Brett.
Thanks for having me back, Neil.
So, Brett, one of the reasons we wanted to bring you in was to talk through some of the trends we've been seeing across the opening three rounds of the Six Nations. It's always after that break week, three rounds in, just over the midway point, it's a nice kind of nice moment to take stock, I suppose, of where the game is being played, how the tries are being scored, how the set pieces are looking. You've been posting some really interesting infographics on your X, @BrettRugAnalyst, for those interested. There's probably too much info in the lot of them to go through them all piece by piece, but you've been breaking down some of the trends, I suppose, we've been seeing and how teams are approaching the game and how they're scoring tries. And we've asked you to pick out a handful of the stats or facts maybe that are most interesting you now that we're past the midway point.
Yeah, data's now getting trendy in rugby, which is great to see for people like me, for the stats nerds. There's some really fascinating stuff coming out. And I listened to Paul O'Connell talking about their line-out yesterday in his interview he was put forward for press. For me, the one that stood out a lot was two Maul tries out of 60 that was scored all season, out of the first three rounds. Like, only two Maul tries. Like, we go back 10 years. Like, that's at least 10 or 12. So that, to me, is one. Ireland don't seem to be jumping onto the Maul wagon at all. Mm. I think we've only mauled five mauls in total. Mm. It's not something we're now doing. We got 2 meters in total, so that's not something we do. Whereas
two maul meters
in total. Two maul meters. You know, with the pack we have, it was a really strange one. I'd put it in. If we compare that to England, England are 24 mauls for 90 meters. So, like, it's a huge difference between the two sides. And it's for whatever reason, whether Paul O'Connell just feels that that's not a method for us to go forward. I don't know, Bernard.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm thinking about Ireland. Was it the opposition didn't want to maul France, didn't want to maul against England, Italy, maybe wanted to move them around. I'm surprised Ireland's stats are so low. And it's very, very interesting. I think the two maul tries, like, I've seen teams are still, Scotland obviously got one that was probably illegal. The one against Wales. And teams are still piling in backs, etc., 5 yards out. But it's so hard to score now, obviously. I think refs are very lenient on the defensive side there. They tend to, you often hear attacking team bringing it to the ground is the language you hear in the ref mic, and sometimes that's dubious enough.
How often does an attacking team bring them all to the ground?
But you often hear that.
Yeah.
And despite probably being a multitude of penalties you could give against the team, and then refs are happy to allow that team go into a pick and go game. It invariably ends in a penalty advantage, and then obviously maybe they score direct or they go for a quick tap. But the State of the Game conference was on in London last week, and there was no law changes, so they're sticking with what they have. But certainly the feedback I got was that there was an agreement that they would clamp down on the swimming through the maul, which is one of the things that's making it harder to maul. Thinking of Joe McCarthy turnover on the 22 against England. Tyburn is a master, but it's actually something that won't suit Ireland. I think Ireland are a team, when opposition scout them and they look at mauling against Ireland, they see it as being quite dangerous. Again, it's very hard for referees to actually ref that. So that's not a law change. It's just probably an enforcement of a law that may create more opportunities to maul. And again, you would imagine teams like England, who were quite good at it already, will take advantage of that. And obviously Ireland then may readdress things.
Yeah, well, I think even when we look at our next two oppositions, and I think Berners made the point about France and England are not teams that you maul against, whereas I think Scotland and Wales are. So I actually expect those stats to change by the end of the tournament for Ireland.
Yeah, and we'll look into the Ireland line-out specifically a bit later on as well, because you've done up an infographic of its own just for that as well. But to stay on that maul stuff, I find it interesting that World Rugby would be putting a clamp down on maul defence, because it seemed like for years and years and years, like, the general sense around rugby was people were actually a little bit bored of how many tries were being scored and how much attacks relied so heavily on mauls, that we've kind of seen it shift the other way entirely now.
Yeah, because don't forget, the maul is actually a great way of tying in a group of bodies. You know what I mean? So if you look at if you look at off a line out defense, you know, most teams now are so well organized in terms of being able to get away. There's not many opportunities. Not many opportunities in the seam or to go wide. So if you can actually tie people into that maul,
get 16 people. Yeah, you won't in get a yeah, small little space.
If you can get, yeah, if you can get 14 people in one space, it does. It's obviously. It helps bigger bodies, so teams who have big packs, they can use that as a weapon, and they still want to look at the French and South Africans. Pretty much ran this state of the game conference by all accounts. So they like mauling, and in fairness, England like the maul as well. But yeah, I think it's to tie four or to tie a group of people together, and. Being able to create space somewhere else in the field. So I think that's the motivation for it. Yeah, I'm not sure the world will be love mauls. I'm not sure it's going to attract new audiences in across the States and things like that, but it has always been a core part of the game.
As a random aside, I presume you have watched it at this stage, but the Razzie Erasmus and his boys podcast, I've had 3 episodes of it downloaded on my phone for about 4 weeks now, and I want a big afternoon or a big drive to just really sink my teeth into them. I can't bring myself to actually go in just yet. I want a kind of 4 hours to really just dive in.
Hollywood would have been proud of it. It was the best choreographed organic conversation you've ever seen. I mean, they nearly finished it. Like they are absolutely box office. Yeah. Like, you know, and Dan, what do you think of the scrum? Like it was just, he goes, I dream about scrums, but it was very well done. And the fact they called it the state of the game podcast or whatever, like just they and last week I don't know if you saw it, but you know the way Razzie, if they're playing England, he only follows one person on on X England. Last week he was following World Rugby and referees or something like that. Like he's they're very witty and they're pushing the narrative, they're setting the narrative, they're world champions, and to be fair to them, they have conviction around their philosophies and ideas, and they're trendsetters, so you have to admire that too.
100%. I was kind of going to get to that like whether you agree or disagree or like the Springboks or dislike the Springboks, it's incredibly impressive and bold and brave to see like an entire coaching team sitting around and we have absolutely no secrets here. We are going to tell you exactly how we want to play the game.
Yeah, but what it didn't show was the 4 hours beforehand that they decided what the agenda was for what was being recorded. But yeah, they put all the cards on the table. I think they're fun to watch as a coaching group. They do commit quite a bit to the game. And by all accounts, they did run the whole show in World Rugby the other day. And, you know, they're box office. They are, but they have the medals in the pocket.
They absolutely do. Moving on from the mauls then, any other little stat or fact that's jumped out? Could be Ireland related, could be related to any other team, could be a general thing over the tournament.
Yeah, Neil, there's I know people are when you mention data, they all go, oh, here we go. But I think what this data set is showing after the first 9 games is how dominant France are. Like they're scoring 8 tries that originated from their own half. 7 of them are from counter-attack. There's no other teams. I think we'd have to add up the other teams together and they're not even near that. 9 first phase tries. So their whole attitude is we're going to attack and we're going to attack well. They have the pace to do it. But if you compare that with Ireland have 1 set piece try compared to 9. So yeah, the stats are, they're highlighting how far France are in front at this moment in time. But they probably have their 2 hardest games now.
Mm. And with France, you're talking about they have X number of set piece tries and they also have X number of transition tries. Yeah. So it's, you know, been able to do it both ways.
They can attack you anywhere they want, really, you know.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting. So the France that we've seen over the first 3 rounds are playing a style of rugby that's, we haven't seen the likes of it, okay, in terms of efficiency, in terms of being able to have a different set of, I suppose, qualities than everybody else. In November, they were quite poor. Now, I know DuPont didn't play in November, but I did a bit of digging, and apparently November, like they treated it like a preseason. So apparently it was very intense, a lot of meetings, a lot of clarity. And people think, oh, this transition stuff is all off the cuff. It's not. It's embedding that philosophy around being ready to go from deep and the support lines. And obviously, they've got incredible pace from Bia Barry. They've got obviously footwork and creativity from Ramos and Jalibert. But they use November as a stepping stone to the Six Nations. And there's been some casualties. So Aldred, Penno, Fiku. There's certainly rumours that they might have rallied against this new type of training camp, which is incredibly intense. A lot of detail, a lot of meetings. They've been left aside for a while. And this new generation, apparently camp now is quite easy because the work is done and they're winning. And it's fascinating to see it. It'll be fascinating to see like where the weaknesses are, because, you know, Brett was saying two very hard games left. Obviously, if England get back to where we think they can be, that's a Grand Slam decider in Paris. But as of yet, it's hard to see how you can stop France. Scotland, obviously, you now have a 2-week lead into it. You know, have they been able to identify how to stop it? I'd like to identify how to stop England. It's going to be fascinating.
It is remarkable at France. They still seem to have like the same level of the mutinies and the infighting as they did 10 years ago, but now they're just a lethal rugby machine now as well on top of it.
Yeah, and I think Galtier has the backing of the federation. So previously, if you look at the coaches, sometimes the coaches were probably less respected or less well paid than the top 14 coaches that the players came from. In actual fact, they used to say that going into French camp was a step down from the Toulouse environment or the Racing environment, the Toulon environment, whereas now I think it's a step up. I mean, the quality of coaching, the management, the facilities, the prestige, it's all there. And Galtier, while he's a Marmite figure in French rugby, no one questions his knowledge of the game. You know what I mean? He might be the best man manager in the world. In actual fact, he's probably one of the worst ones, but he's put people around him who are good at that. You know what I mean? And he's also much easier on people when they're gifted, like the players he has. You know, the biggest challenge for him was in the club game in Montpellier, for example, not understanding why players couldn't see the opportunities he saw or execute it. You know, I remember we had a winger who went to from Grenoble to Montpellier, and he broke him. You know, he broke him. He called every week. He was very hard on him in videos, and eventually he called him in and said, "Look, I'm sorry. It's not your fault. It's my fault. I signed you. You know, you're just not good enough, whatever." So he's not an easy man to please. But when he had like. It's hard to find fault in Dupont and Olivion and Marcia.
Yeah, when you look at them, particularly on the transition stuff and when they, you know, counterattack, when they win the ball back in their own half and just the speed at which they're launching attacks off the back of it. Is there anything you see in that only France could do this? Or is it like, is there any reason why an Ireland team couldn't do that, why another team couldn't do it? Do they have the players that are better equipped to move the ball at that speed? Or is it just the mindset of that's how they play the game?
Well, they have the pace. So if you think of one of the tries to score against Italy, Dupont gets it on the transition. He just hits a long chasing kick down the tram lines and their winger just burns everyone. And you have that, when you have that pace, I'm not too sure even we have that pace that can deal with it. I know Balakoon's come back in and O'Brien are in, but I still don't think they're that quick. And like, they can do anything they want. I've been really impressed with how they've set up defensively. I know they've Sean Edwards in there for a while, but they've got more dominant tackles than anyone else. They're giving away, they've given away 8 penalties in defence. That's so un-French. And he clearly has a bigger say now in how the team operates than he probably used to. He's probably getting more time in the training ground. And I actually can't see a weakness unless you kick long against them.
Mm-hmm. And why is that?
I think they'll struggle. I think it's something South Africa did against them. I think if you kick long, they can't get their counter-attack organised as quickly as they would like to. And I think it's something the Africans did against them in that quarter-final. They did it against them in November. And it's just something they haven't been able to get around.
Yeah, I think Brett's 100% right. If you look at the counter-attack tries they scored, they're normally getting that ball from a kick not far from the half, like maybe 20 yards from the halfway line, so they can get back to the halfway line. Whereas if you can land it in the 22 and make them have to gamble on getting back to their forwards, and obviously you got to shut them down. But I think that's the issue, is that the teams they've played haven't been able to outkick them in terms of kick meters. And so that's something that I'm not sure if Scotland can do, but that's something that I think that is certainly a tactic worth trying. The reason, what could go wrong? Some of those offloads are not going to stick someday, right? Like that's the reality of it. I mean, some of the marginally forward passes are going to be blown up, and suddenly then they could get into a little bit of a rut because every team has a bad day, so they're definitely human. The only thing I would say is it'd be very hard for other coaches to implement that style. One, as Brett said, other teams don't have the same. Other teams don't have Guiar and Olivia on the second row. You know what I mean? Who are back rows basically, yeah, and have that mobility. And you've got basically five back rows in your pack. There's a lot of teams in the top 14 playing this way now. The top 14 has changed. The top 14 used to be maul and brawl. Okay. You know, scrum and kick penalties, scrum and drop goal. Like the fact that the weakness of France at the moment is that there's no props. The weakest part of their team is their props. And it's all the way down. Okay, 20s, there's some props coming through, but the scrum is potentially the weakest part of their game, and again, a South Africa, and England potentially could dismantle them there, and then the whole thing changes. But yeah, it's the philosophy that runs all the way from when they're under fours around playing in transition, keep the ball alive, and Galtier, like if they have a game where 10 offloads go to ground or get intercepted, he's not going to bollock them that week. You know, I mean, that's just their philosophy, but it's higher risk than some of the other games.
Following on from that, like as Bernard said, they're not going to get the bollocking if balls are hitting the ground or if passes aren't sticking. You may or may not have the info there in front of you, but would the numbers back up that because France played so loose like that in possession and are passing it around so much, are they making more mistakes? Do they have more handling errors? Is it essentially just the cost of doing business?
Yeah, so their offloadings is sitting at 54, whereas the nearest team to them is something like 25. Mm-hmm. Who's actually Ireland?
And where did the handling errors stack up? And are they high up on
handling
it as well?
Errors come into it. Yes, their handling errors are far greater than everyone else. Why? Because they're told to play like that. But see, the French have a philosophy is if you make a mistake, it's actually the coach's fault. Whereas in Ireland, if we make a mistake, we're all shouting the players, stop bloody offloading the ball.
Yeah.
You know, whereas that's just their life. And they've been doing it since they were 6, 7, 8, all the way through. Like, that's the Toulouse way, the Bordeaux way, the La Rochelle way. And they're comfortable that if they do make a mistake, so next play, let's get on with it.
What's the next one on the agenda? What's jumping out for you across these first three rounds?
Which is going to stick to France, really. I think their kicking game is really smart. So since Dupont's come back in at 9, those little chip kicks. So most teams are playing 13 across the defence line with 2 fullbacks, so 13-2 back there. So there is actually a chip space for most teams in there. Whereas traditionally, Bernard, you would have played with that kind of safety in behind, which would take away that chip space. Dupont and Ramos, to a degree, can see this space really, really well, and it's something they've brought in. They're chip kicking so much more than anyone else because they see it. They're organising it. I know Gibson Park has a good relationship with Tommy O'Brien for it as well. They do it in Leinster quite a bit. They've done it for Ireland against France as well, but that is an area that's so difficult to defend.
And you've like even just going back to the Ireland-France match, that stacks up as well. You think Jalabert's chip through in the lead-up to Charles Olivon's try as well.
That's right.
It was the scramble back to get it. There's a bounce of a ball and there's a lucky bounce that falls back into his hands. But if you try it enough times, ultimately you're probably going to get the bounce your own
way. True, but like when we look at the kicks that are normally taking place, they're off a slower rook. It's a box kick. It's everyone. You're getting your caterpillars in place. You're getting people in as kind of blockers. You're getting organizing your chase line. Whereas they're chip kicking off a call, off a movement, off fast rook ball, where they're just calling it and they're just playing. And I just think it's so difficult to defend. And it's another string to their bows. And obviously they have Dupont as the one that's doing most of it as well.
And is it that they are doing it considerably more than everyone else, or are they doing it more effectively?
Oh, they're doing it more than anyone else. I think it's 3 times more than anyone else.
Wow. Who would be the next team on that list then?
The next team on the list. Neil, you've got me now. The next team is
off the
actually,
top of my head would be Scotland.
It's actually Scotland. Yeah.
I'm just thinking Finn Russell.
Yeah,
every now and again, just loves one of those little chips over the top. Give us one more before we move on to Ireland's lineout specifically.
Off the top of my head, I would say Wales not scoring or scoring 3 tap plays. They don't seem to be able to create anything. I know. Hopefully, they don't create too much on Friday night, but that's an area that they're struggling with. Their attack is really, really struggling to get any sort of momentum. They're getting into the 22. They're not really putting too much pressure on you after that. But I know even the Irish management talked about it there during the week and recognised Wales' ability to get in there, but they're not really doing a whole lot there.
I'd be interested, Brett. I think I saw your summary of the three rounds was red zone entries over red zone efficiency. It might be something you have for today or whatever, but that's interesting. So Wales aren't bad at getting in there, but lack the grunt to actually make it pay. And then there was an interview with Noel McNamara and Charlie Morgan in the Times talking about basically this idea of, obviously it's very simple, very obvious, but the closer you get to the line, the harder it is. And that's why France are making hay from further out, obviously. But sometimes, you know, only 12 in the front line as teams get reorganized and get their 13-2 in place. And obviously then it's 14-1 and then it's 15-0 as you get closer. But that red zone efficiency is fascinating because I think actually sometimes if you think of England against Ireland the first 15 minutes
522 or first half an hour that 522 entries
and some of them were quite physically intensive in terms like in attack. If your defense is well organized and you're able to win some collisions, it's sometimes harder on the attacking side there, and if you don't come away with anything, it can really be a dent to your confidence. So, again, I'm wondering, that's one thing I haven't seen is a huge amount of creativity in terms of red zone attack. Everybody's kind of doing the same thing, and then it becomes just about power. Whereas you'd love to see a team like Wales, who maybe lacked a little bit of power, be a little bit more creative and try and find an easier way of scoring or creating a bit of momentum.
It's interesting. Well, I looked at the England attack. They're still playing, their back rowers still in the wide channels. When they're against a 15-0 defence, so all 15 of the opposition are up on the line, there's no way you're going to get that ball to that player.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the multi-pass plays aren't going to work there. Whereas if you watch Ireland's 22 attack, all eight forwards are very, very close to the ball, and they have a period, they have a system in place that is totally different to the system they play outside the 22 when it goes to 14-1 / 13-2 defence. And I just think England, I'd be surprised if they don't have an attack in there, but they definitely weren't going to it against Ireland. They were trying to keep that width.
So as you're saying, like further out the pitch with Ireland, for example, they will have like a Dan Sheehan out wide or something, or maybe a back row forward whereas there's a little bit more space to actually move the ball and you can get gain line success. But I suppose once you're that close to the line, if you do get the ball that wide, you're not going to need someone to carry two people over the line with them.
So look at Dan's positions on Friday night if he does start or if he comes on. He will be in those outside channels outside the 22, but when they get into the 22, he's one of their main ball carriers. He's central part to getting the ball over the line. He's obviously really good at it. You know, he's obviously central part to the tap play as well.
Yeah, the example probably for people is the Balakoon try against Italy where Izetchukwu got a big carry down the left. And obviously we went from left to right. Now we ended up scoring with the offload from Stockdale. But if you had a wide camera on that, a wide angle on that, Izetchukwu would have left that wing and he'd be coming to join up those forwards and get into ground and pound game.
It's funny though, you mentioned Wales' inefficiency in the 22 and how so many of their tries are coming from 5 metre pick and goes. It was Simon Easterby actually mentioned that on Thursday when he was speaking to the media, but he referenced it in they're very dangerous off those 5 metre pick and goes. You can look at these things in a couple of different ways. The stats can tell you whatever they want you to tell, I suppose, can't they?
You can manipulate them and sell them to the media all you want.
Right. That's, I suppose, a few of the off-the-top-of-the-head stats that you kind of feel illustrate, I suppose, tell a story of this Six Nations as well. We will move it on, though, to Ireland's lineup because you've put together a very very interesting infographic here for us that I'll just eventually scroll across to about, I suppose, what Ireland are doing with their lineout. Not so much how their lineout is performing in terms of the percentage. It's around a 90% success rate at the moment. But I suppose we asked you to look a little bit more into this because of what Paul O'Connell said yesterday about it. He was just asked in general terms, what have you thought of the lineout so far in these opening three games? There was no criticism of it. There was no praise of it. This was his honest thoughts. it was probably okay. We conceded a maul try against Italy, which was disappointing. We haven't mauled much ourselves, but we have, and we haven't scored a maul try. It was a little bit sloppy against Italy, certainly towards the end of the game. Our ball winning was good against England. We won great ball at the tail, but we didn't deliver it properly. It probably goes down in the stats as a 100% line-out, but we really didn't get a lot out of it. It's an important part of the game for us and a part of the game that the lads have worked really hard on. It's probably a little bit better than it was in that New Zealand game in the autumn, but there's still room for improvement. The line that probably jumps out there is, it goes down in the stats as a 100% line-out, but we didn't really get a lot out of it. When we look at line-outs, we often look at the numbers 80, 90, 100%, good, bad, indifferent. We don't really look at what teams are doing with it. So I suppose the question would be, is an 80% line-out that delivers tries more efficient better than a 95% line-out that doesn't really do much with it?
Yeah, I think what Paul's getting at is they look at line-outs differently, and all coaching staff do. They're looking at the quality of the ball. Was it good enough to go forward?
Mm-hmm.
So was it good enough to set up that maul? Was it good enough to delivery to the nine? Whereas the stats that are produced on the TV, if it's just tap back on your side and you're putting your scrum half under pressure, they probably don't count that as a quality stat. Mm-hmm. Whereas the media will go, yeah, that's a line out one, but it's not really ball we can attack off. It's not one clean. So that clean, those clean line out stats are far better. But just the reverse, like Paul O'Connell was under severe pressure for line out.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of people questioning him as a coach. So we have to actually say, look, this, like the last Six Nations, it was excellent too. Mm-hmm. This Six Nations, it is one of the top lineouts in mm-hmm. in the tournament. I think France have won. They've lost one lineout in the whole tournament, but Ireland's lineout is excellent. But when you cut it down and start looking at the numbers they've used, I think this is quite interesting.
Mm-hmm.
They use an awful lot of 5+ lineouts, so it's 5-man plus a forward mm-hmm. or 6+. But they've used 9 different formations. So they're becoming quite hard to analyse if you're in opposition.
Well, sorry for interrupting. When you say 9 different formations, what do you mean when you say formations? Is that just the makeup of where the pods are?
Yeah, so they could have a 7-man lineout, a 4-man lineout, a 5-man lineout. They also have their plus lineouts. They actually have used a 3+ lineout as well as part of an exit strategy as well. So they have 9 formations. If you're an opposition analyst or an opposition coach and you're prepping for 9 formations, that's a really tough gig. That's a really tough day in the video room. It's a tough day in training. And it encourages you not to actually set up a line-out defence and defend them on the ground. And that's something we've seen with Ireland in the last while. I'll give you an example. If we look at Wales, their 5+ line-out is sitting at around 45, 50%. So that's their go-to line-out.
Mm-hmm.
So Ireland now have to prep for that line-out. They'll have to make a decision whether they're going to challenge it. Is there an opportunity to steal the ball off it? Or are we actually going to stay down? So the rep work there is actually going to be lower. Whereas you're prepping for Ireland, there's a lot of lineouts going on there.
Yeah.
And the variety of it, it's very hard to pick apart. So I think we have to say Paul O'Connell's done a pretty good job at rescuing this lineout.
Yeah, and it's great to see the information and the stat and the breakdown of it. Just something that came into my head there, thinking about it. An interesting addition to the camp this year was Darren Murray, okay, from Connacht, right? He is a specialist. Like, Connacht's defensive lineout has been incredibly good over the last 3 or 4 years. He is a lineout guru now.
So is his brother incredibly. Yes. I'd love to have seen what home life was like back when they were teenagers and stuff. Because I remember for a couple of years in a row, Niall had, like, by far and away the highest number of line-out steals in the URC.
Yeah, no, they live for it, and it's just interesting. So he may not see, unlikely to see action this Six Nations, but I've no doubt that his role on match weeks is to basically put the attacking line under as much pressure as possible. Like, Ryan Baird has become a defensive line-out guru. He's obviously not there. Obviously, Ryan Baird was in the team, but you can be sure that Darren Murray has a pack every week who are defending like Italy, defending like England, and it just means that you're better prepped. You know what I mean? So I'm not saying it's not down to the coaches, but he was an interesting addition to the squad because I don't think any of us, when we look at him, see him as being an international lock in terms of athleticism. But at some stage, Ireland need to have that safety of having an outstanding line-out caller and build athleticism around him. So his exposure to the camp this Six Nations, I think, has been good. And obviously, potentially, it's helping us be better on our attacking line as well.
And Darren Murray was only brought in as one of the development players initially. He was only meant to be going to Portugal for the few days and not going to Paris. And he's ultimately stayed in the Ireland squad throughout. So obviously there's something there they're seeing in him. As you said, even if he's not going to earn a cap in this Six Nations, if he is England or France or Italy or Wales or Scotland on a given week in training, there's a huge amount of value in that.
Look, there'll always be a pack who are playing the opposition, but some are better at it than others, you know, and it's rare to have somebody in Irish game especially who actually craves this defensive side of it and can organise, can read, can pick up body language cues, etc. So it's just an interesting side on. Look, it's great. It's just great to see the Irish line out having such variety and being a bit more successful.
I might ask you about the merits and the differences between, we'll say, a five man and a 5+1. Can you explain for those of our listeners and viewers who don't necessarily know what the plus one means or what it offers? What is the plus one? Who is the plus one?
So the plus one is the red scrum cap of Josh van der Vlier, probably most of the time for Ireland. He's got a number of jobs. So he's the first hands on the ball. They might be setting up a mall and they'll build it on that.
He's effectively subbing in for the scrum half.
Yes, he's subbing in for the scrum half.
A line out forward instead of a scrum half.
Yeah, but what Ireland have added over the last number of years is that Josh is actually a good distributor of the ball. So he'll come in and they'll go for a fake mall for around 2 to 3 seconds, and then you'll see him pull out and then launch plays off that, where he might actually hit Jemison Gibson Park. He might hit a blindside wing coming around the corner. And they have these lovely little launch plays from that, these little breakout plays. And Josh does it better than anyone else. Mm-hmm. I don't know of too many other players that can play it as well as that. We saw Chisholm trying to play it against Ireland.
Threw it down at someone's feet.
Down on someone's feet. I think they gave away a penalty. Ireland kicked in the corner and they're back in the attack again.
Yeah.
Now it is a specialist skill, and Josh is as good as anyone.
How long has that been in vogue?
It's 5 or 6 years, I'd say. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Frenchies, they do a nine 5+1. So they'll have a 5+1 with a 9 at the front. Like basically just keeping the front part honest. But then what can happen is the one can shift out and the 9 can sweep around, and then you basically get an extra strike runner. Like, there's lots of different variations on it. Mm-hmm. But the plus one is when a team see a plus one, they have to be more concerned about the maul first of all. Even though obviously we've seen from Brett's stats that Ireland don't maul that much, but it does keep your maul honest. And then if you have someone who's athletic like Josh is, who can get out and away quickly and is a good distributor, it gives you multiple options. Yeah,
the other one they've added to it is that Josh will come in and lift.
Yeah,
so of the 5+, you can actually get more or less a 6 man into your line out.
But someone has to step out.
So you'll see the front man will step out. So Jeremy Lockman, if he's at the front, will step out. You legally can't go in until the ball leaves the hooker's hands. But I'm not too sure too many refs are seeing too much of that.
Yeah.
In fairness, that is a minefield for refs to have to look for. Players switching in and out of malls all the time. Before we move on from the lineouts as well, just down at the bottom end of that infographic, you've kind of gone through where Ireland are targeting their throws. So as we see, we've 16 throws to the front, 10 throws to the middle, 5 to the back, and 2 of them going beyond the 15-metre line. So 43% to the front, that's Ireland are taking safe ball at the front more often than not.
Yeah, I like the long ones over the top. I think we've launched some really good attacks from that one, where we're bypassing everyone in the line-out and we're playing across the top either to one of the back rowers who's left the line-out or one of the centres coming through. I think it's a nice little string to their bow, and it really keeps the opposition guessing. What I like about this, and again, it will differ depending on where the line out is on the pitch. Mm-hmm. So this is just for all zones, like from inside their own half, they might be a bit more conservative and throw to that banker at the front. But what I like about this is it actually shows Ireland have this ability to go front, middle and back, to keep it in simple terms. You know, and I'm not too sure too many teams have that. Like the French are over 50% to the front. They have a line out that doesn't have too many line out jumpers. Mm-hmm. They have a lot of back rowers. They kind of have what I call 3/4 jumpers. No real outstanding ones. England are the same. England are picking three sevens. I think, I personally think England need to go back to a six in their back row, or sorry, a line out jumper in their back row. I think one of the advantages of playing Tadhg Byrne there is he's obviously a quality line out jumper, you know, and like we've missed that with Ryan being injured as well.
Any final line out thoughts?
No. Trucking along nicely. So hope it operates on Friday.
We've properly jinxed it now for the weekend. Completely. Let's stay on set pieces. Scrum. I did want to talk about it last week, Bernard, but we got so carried away talking about how brilliant Ireland were last week against England. We didn't really get too much into the improvements. And the scrum is the big thing that jumps out, the big thing that needs to improve. Held up fine against France in the opening round. But as you kind of said, the more we've seen of France, the scrum probably is the weakest area of their game at the moment with the way they're playing. But Italy and England have had a proper cut off Ireland now. They're struggling to shake off that that reputation that they've come into the Six Nations with.
Yeah, it's remarkable how convincingly we won the game, considering our scrum was as dominated as it was. Now, in fairness, I thought there was a big focus. I thought Furlong, he certainly wasn't going to go up in the air. He was going to go aggressively across rather than that risk going up. And that made it. There's no lowlights video of those scrums, if you get me, you know, like there was in Italy. So it was better. And probably it's hard to expect it to go from the way it was against Italy to being like perfect against England. There's too many broken parts of that scrum to fix in a week. I'd like to think that the 2 weeks, even though they only had a short camp the week after England, gives them another chance to make some fixes to it. And Wales, if Wales don't start Nicky Smith, I think we should be okay.
Nicky Smith destroyed Ireland last year.
Nicky Smith, and he destroyed Leinster, if you remember, for Leicester. He is a very destructive...
And Connacht in the Challenge Cup as well. Right.
so he loves playing Irish teams. He probably won't be in a team, though, because Rhys Carey has done so well in terms of carry, and they're probably lacking other carriers who could allow to make a selection based on the scrum. But I think we'll be okay this week, and we'll be okay against Scotland. So yeah, we've played the two best scrummaging teams, Italy and England, already. So, and obviously we have to factor in Porter and McCarthy and Boyle being out. So yeah, it's amazing that we were able to beat England, as I said, with such a weak scrum area.
What are you seeing in it, Brett?
Yeah, I thought their scrummage height was much better against England, and England still put us under pressure, but compared to where it was against the Italians. And I know it's difficult, Dan is a tall man, to get down that low, but I actually thought when you go through the first two or three scrums, you can actually see him trying his hardest to get down there, not to let them get under it. But yeah, look, it is a concern. I just hope they don't brush it under the carpet and go, well, we're missing three props. Well, we're only missing one, if that makes sense, because the others are on the bench.
And even when we had all those props, the scrum wasn't firing on all cylinders either.
The replacement of the three props is still a World Cup player. Yeah. Like Jeremy's still in the world, or was in the last World Cup squad.
I did see, I don't know, did you see over the last couple of days, there was a story on, I think it was The Athletic, about the way Arsenal are scoring so many goals from corners now.
That it's a plague in the game.
Their set piece coach is on like a goals bonus at the moment. Can we get John Fogarty on a scrum penalties bonus?
he'd like that.
He'd love it. Yeah.
Dan is definitely on one down in South Africa.
As long as you don't dock him when we give away a penalty, he'll end up owning the IRFU money. No.
That's my idea going forward.
He'll fix it.
The IRFU can have it for free.
It doesn't help. Like if you look at the provincial stuff. There's not really a coherent scrum philosophy across the provinces, so everyone's kind of doing their own thing, which is fine until there's a weakness at the senior level.
Bit of a random one on the scrum. What's happened to Breakfoot? It's just vanished as a thing. It came in. There was a big clampdown on it, and it only popped into my head. It was when I was rewatching the Ireland Italy match, and it was into the second half because I remember Ronan Kelleher was on at this stage, and a scrum had collapsed, and the Italian hooker said to the referee, he's not putting up his break foot. So I was like, okay, I'm gonna start watching this now. And they reset for the scrum, and clear as day, there's no break foot from Ronan Kelleher, but there's no break foot on the Italian side either. And he was just complaining about it 2 seconds earlier, and it's waved away. And I watched it. I was keeping a closer eye on it in the round three games, and no, absolutely no one has a break foot up. No one's looking out for it. But I do wonder, like, how does not kind of keeping that clampdown going affect the stability of scrums in general? Does it all even out?
It all evens out, yeah. Once, but like, I think what gets measured gets done. So I would believe that refs, when they get their appraisals or their reviews, aren't being held to account around a break for the scrum. It'll probably be offside line, it'll be tackle not rolling away, or another area that's probably more important. And teams now have just decided to crack on, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, if you're trying to win that speed across the line, which teams are, that imaginary line, well, then the break foot doesn't help you. It actually can be a blocker. So teams have stopped doing it. It's like in the top 14, they've tried to clamp down on not straight feeds from scrum halves. And effectively, most matches, there's a free kick to both teams at some stage.
One
around,
each.
Around the middle of the field, where it's not going to be focused on as a harsh call. And then everyone just puts in crooked. So yeah. It's not important enough, I think, to have grabbed referees' attention that it's on their checklist. And mm-hmm. players adapt very quickly. Players are trying to find the edge. And I think having a break foot, if the opposition don't have a break foot, slows your ability to create power across on the engage, and then you'd get rid of it.
Who knows? There might be a flurry of penalties on it now at the weekend. And then we will know, all the powers that be, all the higher ups are avid RT Rugby podcast listeners and viewers. Potential changes this weekend. It's funny because, like, on one hand, you would love to just see a couple more players get an opportunity. But when Ireland finally clicked into gear as they did against England, you'd be quite reluctant to mess with that formula now that they've just got back into their flow.
Yeah, I'd be reluctant to change, to be honest. I think Andy Farrell has got momentum here with this team. And I think he needs to set himself up to win a triple crown. I know people will sniff at that, but I don't think we can. I think if we look at the tournament after the French game, if we can win four games, I think we've had a really successful tournament. I think the interesting one for me is who starts instead of James Lowe. Do you leave Tommy O'Brien, who I thought was absolutely brilliant in Twickenham? Do you leave him to play on the left wing, or do you bring Stockdale in, who's left-footed, who's played in the left wing before? So I think that, to me, is going to be a bit of a 50-50 call. I'll go with my blue-tinted glasses. I'd like to see Tommy play, but obviously Jacob's playing pretty well as well.
Where do you sit on that? Tommy O'Brien or Jacob Stockdale?
I'd go Tommy. And I know the left foot is massively important.
But Jamie Osborne has exactly. That as well.
So, we'll be fine with Osborne. I know you could say, well, look, at Stockdale and Tommy O'Brien both were sacrificed for poor performance against France. Tommy's got his chance to respond. Wouldn't it be great to see Jacob? And I agree with Brett, he's been in great form for Ulster, but I don't know, I thought Tommy was so good, you'd really stick with him. Again, I would keep change to the minimum. I actually would like to see Keller get a start in the Six Nations. I don't think there's the gulf between them that means that one guy starts every match. So I don't think that'd be any harm for Owen to start, for Dan to bench, or even Tom Stewart to come on. The challenge is, obviously, this is the game that you want to make a few changes, and it comes on the back of a fallow week. So for Farrell's point of view, like, he really probably wants to just go full Metal Jacket for 2 weeks now and then finish as high as possible. But I also do think, you know, if Nathan Doak is a genuine option as second choice, Gibson Park's clearly number one, would you give him a run? Tom Stewart, I'd have no issue with him getting a chance as well. But I'd be slow to make too many changes. Maybe a Dogbo, have another look at him. I think Bundy's going to come back in on the bench.
Yeah, 23. I'd imagine.
Yeah, and we go 5-3. But yeah, I think in terms of building squad morale, again, just a little dabble in some of the guys a little bit further back to show confidence in them, but without massive changes and risking the fight. Like, it's really important for Farrell and Ireland that we back it up now.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We back it up. We've had a great performance. That's what we've been waiting for. But now show that that's the new level.
Someone that didn't get mentioned there, Nick Timoney, who's been absolutely brilliant off the bench three times in a row, almost to the point where you'd be kind of going, has he been too good off the bench three times in a row that they're like, geez, he's so good off the bench, we might just keep him there?
Yeah, and maybe, like, I'd say for Timoney, given how many times he would have been back up the road to Belfast with disappointment, just being the matchday squad is probably, you know, something that he's loving, and he's playing a big role in games. So Josh, I think, marked his territory with his performance against England. He showed why he is number one. I think because he's had a rest already, I'd stick with Josh, but Timoney to definitely stay in the squad and come off the bench again.
Yeah, keep an eye out for Nick Timoney. Was up doing media yesterday. There'll be quotes from him later on in the week. Had some really interesting things to say about just his attitude towards like kick chase and that being a point of difference in his game. Like, do you remember the kick Jameson Gibson-Park had at the against England at Twickenham? He chased it down. He makes the tackle. Gibson-Park gets in there. I've never seen someone speak so highly of kick chasing. Just absolutely loves it. It's incredible.
Tell you what, if you can convince players to love kick chasing, you should be selling for Amazon or something.
Yeah. Well, he had a good story about kind of how that got into his head as a potential kind of point of difference for him. But anyway, you can read it later on in the week. The Andy Farrell situation has kind of been bubbling away over the last couple of weeks and his potential future. It first kind of came out in Rugby Rama in France that Saracens had been in touch with about taking over in 2027 after the Rugby World Cup. Then the Irish Independent went kind of deeper on it last week as well. And that prompted Saracens to make a statement. Andy has not discussed his future with anyone on the board or ownership group of Saracens, and we can categorically state, despite numerous reports of the contrary, that no offer has been made to Andy. It was a sort of an interesting statement, Brett, in that it said a lot, but it also specifically didn't refer to other things that, you know, they said they haven't spoken to Andy and they kept talking about Andy, but, you know, Andy's agent, I imagine, does a lot of those conversations for him.
Yeah, look, it's pro coaching. Every sport is the same. You've got to be one contract ahead of where you currently are. Like, Andy's got a youngish family and obviously he is English. He is former Lions coach. He is one of the top international coaches in the world. I'd imagine the Saracens aren't the only ones that would be interested in Andy Farrell. He's got to negotiate the best deal with himself, but like no one is, well, I'm not aware that anyone's asked Andy, what does he like to do? Mm-hmm. Has he happy with his time in Ireland and wants to try club coaching? Does he want to go into that? Like, club coaching is every single week, week in, week out. It's a tougher gig than the international scene that only works on a summer tour, a November international, and then the Six Nations. Now, they're obviously really intense windows. But going back into club coaching, that would be a tough one. But he's got to stay ahead of the contract that he's currently on. Mm-hmm. And he's out of contract in 18 months. No, sorry, yes. 19 months. So he's, like, if he's negotiating, that's so be it. Maybe the IRFU want to keep him on it either, which we don't know whether they do or not. Maybe they've had enough.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. It's just a funny narrative kind of heading in. Coming off the back of that England game, we were all going, hey, this is great again. This is fantastic. And now we're going, oh God, is Andy Farrell thinking of leaving after the World Cup? And who knows? Like, I've seen plenty of people put the thought out there as well as, do you know what? By this stage, at the end of 2027, he would have been in Ireland for 11 years. He would have done 7 years as the Ireland head coach, 2 World Cup cycles as the Ireland head coach. In so many people's circumstances, that is a very natural endpoint and a good way for everyone to shake hands and say, well done on a job, fairly well done, and move on and start building for the future. There's 100% that school of thought as well.
Yeah, it's a long tenure, but to be fair, that school of thought is... from what I can see, outside of people who actually work with him, mm-hmm. he has an amazing ability to keep things fresh, to have no fatigue with his style of management. It's so rare. It's so rare to have someone who's been in tenure that long and not have upset players who are coaches who work for him. It's so unusual, which would lead you to believe that it is possible to extend, you know, mm-hmm. and not have a big drop. I actually think it's really important. Like, if you look at the depth, the next coach for Ireland post the next World Cup, he or she is very important because it doesn't look like there's the same quality there. And obviously, you're going to lose your Bundy, you're going to lose your Gibson Park, you're going to lose your Tyke Furlong, probably, you're going to lose your James Lowe's. And they have been generational players. So that's you need a right man. So like look at New Zealand. New Zealand sacked the coach. They still haven't been able to. The interviews are next week. Like, it's not simple. even the All Blacks with coaches spread across the world, former All Blacks, etc. And they have an obvious solution to that. You know, Benetton just signed Wayne Pivac. Like, there's, it's the same faces kind of going around. And which of those would be ideal for Ireland to come in and rebuild a team? I'm not sure there's an obvious candidate who even lies up with Farrell, you know. And don't forget, England could be looking for someone new. Like, France could be looking for someone new. Like, Galtier could decide. Galtier wants to coach in an English-speaking country. At some stage, he may decide that's the time to go. So there's not obvious candidates who are willing to work within the confines of the system here, which has its strengths but also has its weaknesses in terms of player depth.
So if I'm putting words in your mouth, if they're like, realistically, there does have to be a big rebuild done on an Ireland squad post the 2027 World Cup, because so many players will be retiring and a new generation has to come in. If there's one person you want to actually oversee that new generation,
I would say Farrell, yeah.
Yeah.
I think if he's already in our camp, I actually think the IRFU need to
lock him down.
Lock him down.
Good stuff. I'm sure it'll rumble on for a little while anyway. We're running out of time, so we can't get into the nuts and bolts of the Irish provinces and the URC at the weekend. Leinster and Ulster both lost. Went to Cardiff and Ospreys. Nice little warning sign ahead of Ireland-Wales at the weekend as well. Munster got their win against Zebra, 21-7. Didn't get the bonus point, but defeats for others around them meant it actually was a reasonable enough weekend for them in terms of closing the gap at the top. Connacht, though, massive 15-10 win against Glasgow Warriors. Came from 10-3 down, try in the last minute. Sean Jansen with the maul try at the end, which is just what they needed with the new stadium opening and get that big roar. But a decent bit of news around the Irish provinces this week. Mike Prendergast leaving Munster at the end of the season. Rod Seib leaving Connacht as well. Similar enough scenarios, I would say, Bernard, in terms of guys who probably signed up for a job that didn't realise they were going in for. Prendergast obviously went for the Munster head coach job. He'd been locked down as a contract extension anyway before that. But, you know, when you have a new coach coming in, didn't necessarily pick those people to work with, that can create a little bit of friction. And Rob Seib, from what we all understand, you know, he signed up to join Connacht before Pete Wilkins was even gone, let alone before Stuart Lancaster was appointed.
Yeah, I think Rob was going to be senior coach or certainly have a big role. And it was just unfortunate for him that Stuart Lancaster was the man they landed on, who obviously does attack and defence. So it's pretty natural that he would look for an opportunity. I think Leicester Tigers is where he's going. He's worked with Jeff Parling before. I think they're... attack coach Pete Hewitt has come back to Australia, so there's an opportunity there. Bit of movement, I think. Obviously, I think Gleeson was in Bath. Prendy's replacing him. He's supposed to be going to Quinns. Quinns obviously looking for DOR. Connacht, I think, have signed Etienne Estes in the Lions lock to replace Joe Joyce. Very experienced player. I think he's in his 30s now, but he's been around the block, big lump. I think they're looking for a tight head, obviously, to replace Jack Ainger. What else is happening? Oh yeah, Prendy obviously going to bat. So, I think Mike Prendergast, he's an international coach now in terms of his profile. So he's left Ireland, gone to Grenoble, Oyonnax, Racing. Sorry, Grenoble, Oyonnax, Stade, Racing, Munster, Bath. You know what I mean? So, like, you've got just those last three clubs, Racing, Munster, Bath. They are three serious clubs, logos to have on your CV. He's gone back to work with Finn, who obviously he's worked with in Racing. What Bath are building there is pretty attractive in terms of the players they have, the new stadium, training facility, etc. And I think it sets Mike up to be a head coach somewhere if he wants. It sets him up potentially to go into international rugby as an attack coach or backs coach, or to come back to Munster as an attack coach or one of the other Irish provinces. So even though he's a Munster man and a Limerick man, I actually think because his CV now is so populated with different experiences, he potentially could go to Leinster, Ulster, or Connacht if he wants to come back. You know, he's not pigeonholed as a Munster coach. And I think if you want to be a coach for your life, and that's your profession, you have to be very careful not to be pigeonholed as a Connacht coach or an Irish coach, you know, to get that international experience. So someone like Goodman, for example, and the Kiwis are brilliant at this. They have their overseas experience and they go and build, whether it's a consultancy slot in Japan or whether it's coming to UK. And it just gives them a bigger network and a better range of experience to stay in the game long enough to get to your retirement. And that's what a lot of them, and retirement can be a long way off for coaches. So it's, I think it's future proof in your CV, what Brendy's doing.
Retirement for coaches can be very soon.
Yeah, I'm talking about natural. I'm talking about actually retiring on your own terms. So I think what Prendy's doing is really smart. Mm-hmm. And I also think for Munster it's an unbelievable opportunity because I've said this since the start. I think Clayton McMillan should be allowed to put his own coaching staff mm-hmm. together and then judge him on. And obviously the own play, to try and, it's very difficult in Ireland with the foreign player things, but to try and put his own stamp on his playing group and then give him time to be successful. And hopefully he is. If not, then you know you make a change based on giving him all the tools you can to support him.
Mm-hmm. Finally, then, before we go as well, the bit of news yesterday, and there's going to be a lot of change at Leinster this summer. Just a good few players, experienced players moving out the door. Confirmed yesterday, Luke McGrath leaving, joining Perpignan. Like pushing 250 Leinster appearances is a remarkable number in professional rugby. And throw in 20 Ireland caps in there as well, going to Perpignan. The unveiling video that Perpignan put out was probably the highlight of it all. The most dramatic video I think I've ever seen for a signing unveiling.
It was the most dramatic video, but I think it might have been the most traumatic video for the former Leinster players that have erased that Perpignan semi-final.
For those who haven't seen it, just go online and look for it. It's on the Perpignan socials, but it is basically Luke McGrath giving a voiceover talking about his experience of going to see Leinster and Perpignan in the 2003 Heineken Cup semi-final, which Perpignan stunned Leinster in.
Which Leo Cullen played in that game, so yeah. I'm sure he wasn't too popular with Leo.
And you get the impression it's turned Luke McGrath into a lifelong Perpignan fan the way he spoke in the video. It's remarkable.
I want to know, did he go to the final the following week against Toulouse? But anyway, yeah, look, Luke is a huge, huge loss for Leinster. And I'm going to say not just as a player. He is a kind of a father figure to the young academy kids coming up.
He was a captain at a very young age at that province as well, when there were a lot of experienced players in there.
He's just a role model professional, and I think Leinster will really, really miss that. Plus, we're going into a World Cup year. Gibson Park isn't going to play a whole lot for Leinster in URC terms. So it's what's coming up next. So what's below Luke? That's going to be the big question for Leinster.
Mm-hmm. I was lucky enough to coach Luke when he was in school. He was captain. He's always been an unbelievable leader. He's an absolute gent. And I think he would be a big loss for Leinster, as Brett says, on and off the field. But also for him, what an opportunity, you know, to go and live in a great part of France, a club that's very passionate. And the signings they're making, they've signed Sarah Reese as well. Like, they're down the bottom of the top 14 this year. They'll survive. Montauban will go down. But they're making recruits early to make sure they're not in that situation next year. And if that club gets on a roll, Luke will have an unbelievable time down there. Experience the top 14, but also experience the Catalan lifestyle. I would advise any Irish player, if they can get a chance to play in France at some stage of their career, try and do it. It's different level.
Like 30, 31, is he? Or is he even a bit younger?
He's about 31. Yeah.
He left school in 2011, I think.
Yeah. So he's few years ahead of him. Nice few years to enjoy the south of France. Beautiful part of the world. Young
family.
2 years
on the chômage afterwards on the dole. 6,000 a month. To sit in your hole. lucky man.
What a way to leave it. We'll leave it there. So Bernard Jackman, Brett Igo, thanks a million for joining us. A reminder, Ireland against Wales in the Guinness Six Nations on Friday night from 7 p.m. on RT2 and RT Player. You can follow a live blog as well on the RT News app or on rt.ie/sport. And there's live commentary as well on an extended Inside Sport on RTE Radio 1. We'll speak to you again soon.